Thinking about self-publishing and don't know where to start? Join the Spa Girls each week for a fun podcast filled with honest advice, tips, and resources. I'm Trudy J.
I'm Shar Barrett.
I'm Cheryl Phipps.
I'm Wendy Vella.
Wasn't that a good new intro that I just did? Oh my God, it's all about her.
Of course it is. If you know where they're at yet.
Anyway, sorry, enough about me. This week we have an awesome guest with us. We've got Darian Smith. Yay! Thanks for joining us. So Darian is actually, he's an awesome writer, but he's also, would you call yourself a psychologist or a counsellor? What's the correct terminology?
Yeah, so my official term, I guess, is counsellor. I'm a member of the New Zealand Association of Counsellors, so let's go with counsellor.
Okay. So that's awesome. So he does both. He's got both hats, and he's going to talk about how he uses the counselling side of his career in the writing, which I think is going to be awesome. So first of all, though, I'm going to read your bio, Darian, and then we're going to get right into it. So here we go. I'm going to bring it up in front of me so I can see it. Darian Smith is a fantasy author based in Auckland, New Zealand. He's published 6 fiction novels, plus been in multiple anthologies, and has won both the Romance Writers of New Zealand Koru Award and Specfic New Zealand's Sir Julius Vogel Award, which is very cool. In his day job, he's an outreach worker for the Haemophilia Foundation and a counsellor slash family therapist. He's also written an awesome book called The Psychology Workbook for Writers, Tools for Creating Realistic Characters and Conflict in Fiction, which talks about how authors, you just showed up the image of the book, which talks about how authors can use psychological theories and counselling ideas to help create compelling, well-rounded and understandable characters. And that's what we're going to talk to him about today. And I am fascinated. This is awesome. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, you guys. I've listened to you before, and of course I know you guys. In the real world, we've actually met.
Yeah, because he's a Kiwi like us. That's why.
Yay. So we do like having Kiwis on the show.
Yeah, we do.
We do. Okay. So to start out, Darian, tell us a little bit how you got into writing and particularly self-publishing. Like, where did it all come from?
Yeah, so I think probably like a lot of people was, you know, someone who was fascinated by stories and reading from a really, really young age. You know, I was that kid that my parents thankfully took along to the library every week, and I took out as many books as the library would let me take and read them all, and you know, just loved stories always. And then when I was at school, you know, we had those creative writing kind of exercises, and all the other kids would be like, oh, this sucks, and hand in, you know, half a page, and I'd be like, woohoo. 3 pages later, my poor teacher had to read it all and probably wondered what on earth she'd gotten into. So I started writing in my teenage years. I wrote my first actual novel, started when I was 16 in a flash of brilliance and inspiration, finished it and fully expected to be rich and famous immediately. Fortunately, had learned enough during that time that I knew to leave, put it aside for a few months, come back and you know, do a quick edit and, you know, correct a few typos and then be rich and famous. Fortunately saw that it was in fact utter garbage, as most novel attempts are. That was a wonderful learning experience. But I had the bug, and I couldn't stop. So I've continued to write ever since. And in terms of the self-publishing side of things, it was a little while later that I really got serious about writing. Started, you know, winning some short story competitions and things like that. So I was like, okay, objectively, this no longer sucks. This is good. And so I got myself an agent, which was really great, with a manuscript. But it was taking a really, really long time. And this was when self-publishing was becoming quite a thing, and being kind of an indie author was becoming a thing. And I was fortunate enough to Specfic NZ, which is still an organization for fantasy and science fiction and horror. Here in New Zealand, we're running at that time a grant. So I was like, okay, I'm going to apply to the grant. throw my hat in the ring. If I get it, then that can fund the self-publishing side of things. If I don't get it, then I'll continue to wait and see what happens with the agent and the traditional publishing side of things. And I got the grant. So fate decided. And I was like, you know what? Let's just do it. So
yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I love that. Amazing. I love that you got the grant to do it. That's
yes.
Very cool.
So let's talk a little bit about your book and were you kind of, did you immediately go, right, I'm going to use all my psychological theories that I've learned at university and beyond and put them all in my books? Or was it something that you kind of figured out over time? How did that kind of connection?
It kind of happened as I went along. Like I very quickly, as I was sort of training in psychology, because you know, I was did that at university and got my degree in psychology, and I was writing at the same time, and I was recognizing that there are a lot of overlaps here. Like writers are instinctively observers of human behavior and translate that into the page and into their stories. And psychology is essentially just a formalization of that in some ways, and sort of a conscious understanding of what's going on.
Yeah.
So some of us, when we're writing, have that knowledge or that instinct, but we haven't necessarily got it formalized. And so sometimes we can get a bit lost if we're just going by instinct. Mm. So I found that, using those theories was actually quite helpful to me.
Yeah.
And so then I started doing a few talks at different events about how I thought this was helpful. And a lot of people would come up to me afterwards and go, oh my goodness, this is really helpful. Why do you not have a book talking about this? And yeah, eventually I went, you know what, why don't I have a book talking about this? Essentially I wrote the book. And I like to keep things short and simple, despite my rambling today.
So I
went, you know what, a lot of sort of writing craft books are really big and really kind of padded in a way. So I went, you know, I'm going to keep this really concise. I'm going to just boil down, you know, the 4 years of training that I did to get my counseling qualification, plus the years getting my psychology degree, into the just distilled, corrupt my education into what writers really can use.
Yeah.
Excuse me. So that's what I did. And then I threw at the back of each section some worksheets to make it a little bit easier for people to kind of take that information and convert it into the writing that they're doing.
Mm. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, it does.
So if we're talking about a character in one of our books, what do you think makes a character, what is important about a character? What makes them relatable? Like, what is it that you think people are looking for? If you tell me that, and then we'll go into the actual specifics of some of these theories.
So, I mean, I think people want a character that they can relate to. So there's got to be some depth to them, some kind of motivations and I guess there's, for me, there needs to be something that shows there's more than just that character appeared on that page for the first time. Mm-hmm. You know, if there's a history to the character and an understanding of their views of the world and themselves and what they expect from the world, all of that informs how they're going to behave, mm-hmm. and it informs how they see the world and how they interact with the world. Mm-hmm. And part of what I love about doing this kind of stuff is that, you know, there's always that dilemma about, you know, is a story plot driven or is it character driven? And for me, if you're doing well, the character stuff informs the plot, mm-hmm. and changes the plot.
Yeah.
And, you know, obviously the plot, hopefully, it informs and changes the character, because that's why are they having that experience if not to grow and change as a person?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, kind of all of that comes together in a character that people will believe and like.
Sense. All right, let's drill down, let's get into the good stuff.
Here we go
Everyone ready? Are we ready?
The root canal of character is right.
Oh no, I hate the dentist.
Yeah,
We need a new thing to talk about. Okay, I did actually write drill down in my notes, so I don't know why. Let's talk about one of the psychological theories that you've talked about in your book. Like, give us one of the, I don't know, the biggest and the best, the one that is kind of most useful to our listeners that they're going to be able to go, wow, that's going to amp up my book. Let's talk through it.
Because I was trained in using a whole lot of different theories, what I tend to say to people is kind of have a look at them all, get an overview of them all, and pick the one that suits you best, because there's actually quite a lot of overlap in some of them. So narrative therapy, I guess, is one that pulls immediately to storytellers, because that's about the stories that we tell ourselves and how that affects our thoughts and behavior. But there's a lot of overlap there with transactional analysis, which also talks about the messages that we get as a child and how that translates into this kind of script that we have for our life and what our expectations are in the world. So you can kind of see, you know, script versus story narrative. There's a bit of an overlap between those two theories.
Let's take narrative theory. Let's drill down into that one. Sorry, cool. dentist again. So what is narrative theory, and how would you use that idea of the stories we tell to create a character?
Yeah. So the concept behind narrative therapy is that we tell ourselves a story about everything in the world. So I might tell myself a story about how successful I am or not successful I am as a writer, for example. And if I tell myself that story, say I tell myself the story that I'm, what's the imposter syndrome? So I'm everyone relates to that. Everyone's oh my God. So if I tell myself the story in my head every day that I'm an imposter, then I start to believe that and I act according to that, and it affects my emotions and it affects my behavior and it affects everything about me. The more often that I tell that story, the easier it is for me to tell that story, because actually physiologically that is rooting that message in the brain. It's actually creating neural pathways in the brain that follow that story. It's a bit like if you walk through a field of grass. The first time you walk that path, it's kind of difficult because the long grass is getting in the way. But if you walk that same path every day, that path gets trod down and it's really easy to walk that path. Now, when I want to tell a different story or walk a different path, again, now I have to fight the long grass again. So it's just easier to stick with the story that I'm already been telling. Mm-hmm. But that story might not be the helpful one. Actually, I might need to tell myself a different story.
Yeah.
And so with narrative therapy, what we work with clients to do is to find the evidence that supports the new story that is actually the more helpful story. Mm. Because our tendency, you know, the human brain is an amazing thing, but it's not always helpful and it has little shortcuts. So our tendency is to find evidence that supports the existing story that we're telling ourselves all the time anyway. And there was a fantastic study done on this, and I wish I could remember who it was that did it. Not that it necessarily matters, because it's the outcome that is helpful to us. But there was a study done with lucky people and unlucky people, or rather people who believed that they were lucky and people who believed that they were unlucky. And what unsurprisingly, really, figured out was that they have no real difference in terms of luck, but a lucky person will take note and remember the evidence that supports the narrative that they are lucky. Mm-hmm. So every time they see, you know, a dollar on the side of the road, they think, oh, that's because I'm such a lucky person. Or every time they go to buy something and it's on sale, that's because I'm a lucky person. Whereas the unlucky person, every time there's a red light, oh, of course it is. I'm such an unlucky person. And so they build up the support for that story. And so you can see, you know, our characters, you know, just translating that away from therapy and into writing, that's how they'll approach the world, depending on the story that they're telling themselves about themselves or about the world around them. So you get this kind of interesting thing that you can play with, especially if you've got multiple points of view, where one character sees one set of events and tells themselves a pre-programmed story about it, and another character can see the same set of events and tell a completely different story. And you can set up a conflict between those characters or a chance for them to have some personal growth and development as a result of that.
And with that, so if you were trying for the personal growth concept, it would be a matter of like saying this is their story in the beginning, and through the book they're going to learn that maybe they can have a different story and move process to that.
And I kind of coming back to the overlap with transactional analysis, that's one of the things with that. You can tell I kind of bounce around theories. One of the useful ways to view it with transactional analysis is that our stories, or our life scripts, as they call it in that theory, come from these messages that we get early in life. And those messages might be things like, you know, be perfect or be strong or, you know, don't get close to people or things like that. And so the development can be to recognize, I don't have to be perfect all the time and I'm still okay. Or, you know, I can get close to people and it can be safe for me to do that. I won't get hurt. Or even if I do get hurt, I'll survive, I'll recover, and it's worth it. So yeah, there's those kinds of things that you can play with.
And there, so if you're in the planning stages of your book and you're trying to create this well-rounded character, how do you, are there places to go where you can say, okay, there's a big list of potential stories they could tell themselves? We've got that in the book, or is there other suggested?
Not so much with the narrative sort of stuff, but with transactional analysis, I've got a list of what they call drivers and injunctions. So the drivers are the messages that we get, usually intentionally. They're kind of the positive ones. So they're the be perfect, the be strong, hurry up kind of stuff. And normally those are, you know, those are good traits, but we can interpret them, because of course, you know, we're getting these messages when we're very young and we're not too capable of assessing the value or not of them, and when they should be used and when they shouldn't. So they get embedded in our brains that I'm only an okay person if I am perfect, or I'm only an okay person if I'm strong, or whatever. And then there's another set of messages that are referred to as injunctions, which are more negative ones, and they're usually not intentionally given. Unfortunately, sometimes they are, but that's a whole nother question. And those are the ones around, you know, don't think, don't be yourself, don't exist even, you know, don't have emotions, don't get close to people, those kinds of things. And so there's this push-pull between the two messages where, you know, I shouldn't have feelings and I shouldn't be close to people, but I do because I'm human. And so therefore I have to be extra perfect and extra strong in order to balance that out and be okay. So it can be kind of an interesting, almost like a jigsaw puzzle, I guess, when you're building your character to pick and choose from those two lists and kind of go, how does this fit together? How will that work for the character that I'm trying to make? And does that then inform the story? And then also kind of, if I've got this character who doesn't feel like they should be getting close to other people and has to be perfect all the time, what mix and match should I create the next character to be to challenge those ideas and challenge those beliefs? And then how does that create a story as those two people come together and have to push each other out of their comfort zones and out of their belief system?
Very cool way of looking at it.
That's good. So are there particular character traits that you see or that you think are more powerful than others, for example, or that you see, I kind of want to say commonly in your practice or something, but I don't know if that's quite the right, whether that's going to translate into fiction quite in the same way, but are there ones that you think are more compelling than others, or ones that,
I think with fiction, you know, a big part of it is the conflict stuff, you know. Yeah. So is why I often say, you know, I've corrupted my education, because obviously in therapy we're trying to resolve issues and resolve conflict. In fiction we're creating conflict, because that's where the story is, that's where the interest is. I think any of those traits can be interesting and compelling if it's used to create a conflict in a story. And so that depends on what other characters you match them up with, and what you do with it after that.
Yeah.
It's a great way of looking at it, actually. You know, that whole, the opposites. Yeah. I mean, creating a character and then helping create the other character, that would be sort of against, opposites attract scenario, you know.
It's a great
way to give them each those character traits.
I think it's really helpful, not just in terms of building conflict in the story and that opposites attract thing, but it's also the challenge for each other, and then the growth opportunity for those characters as the story progresses.
Do you spend quite a bit of time before you start a book doing this? Like, do you work on your characters quite heavily before you start a book, like plotting?
I do quite a bit. And I mean, some of this, because this has, you know, been in my head for quite a long time, so some of it's a bit kind of automatic now. I have kind of character sheets, which is not an uncommon thing for people, but it's, you know, not just about height and hair color and eye color. It's also about, you know, what's this character's drivers? What's this character's intentions? What's, you know, what changes in their beliefs and behaviors do I want to see happen through the story, and how's that going to happen? So my series, the Agents of Kalanon series, which has a kind of an ensemble of characters, I actually spent a bit of time going, how do each of these different characters match up, and how do they challenge each other, or what's their relationship because of what their particular psychologies are? And so that was, in many ways, quite fun to kind of go, okay, well, these two will get along. These two really won't, and here's why. And so, there's some good
stuff. Must be quite a bit of adjustment too, because everything changes when you write. I mean, you start at A, but quite often you end up at Z and, you know, in between. So you have to do a lot of readjustment during the book.
Yeah, you certainly can. And hey, this stuff isn't hard and fast, you know, written in stone, because theoretically our characters are human, and humans are very messy and confusing. So, you know, you have those base ideas about what their core beliefs and messaging kind of things are. But then what they do with that and how that's developed over time might be something completely different from one character to the next.
And all of these things would lend themselves to actually how the characters speak to each other, and even the tone that they use, wouldn't it? Because if they're a very terse person, you know, that's the way they speak, and that's the language that they use. But, you know, if they're very soft and shy and that sort of thing, again, it's a different language, isn't it? And body language as well.
Absolutely. And so there's some really fun things that I put in the book that help, or certainly help me with that sort of stuff around I'm trying to think, oh my goodness, what thing do I tell you guys about first? One way of looking at conflict is, like, there's this idea that we generally have three ways that we respond to conflict. So it's either to submit to what's going on, or to use logic to try and argue to get our way, or to go to anger. And people will tend to use those three, like, we'll use all three, but we'll use them in a different sequence. So somebody might initially, for a small conflict, their go-to might be to submit to it. That tends to be me. That's my first go-to. If it's not a big deal, it doesn't really bother me, I'll just go along with whatever. So it has to be a slightly bigger conflict that means more to me before I'll go, okay, actually, now I'm going to sit down and provide you with all the reasons why you should why you should believe me. And then if it is a really big one, you might get me get me angry, and it tends to take a bit to get me angry. But if I do get there, then I'm quite angry, and I'm, you know, you're dead to me. Yeah. Whereas, yeah. you know, someone who goes to anger first might get angry over a little thing, but their anger is brief and it's over fast, and then they're on with their lives and they don't really care, and everything's fine again. Yeah. But if submit is their last one, then by the time you get them to submit, it's a complete, you know, they've given up on everything. It's yeah. ugh. Yeah. So that can be quite an interesting thing to see how characters behave with each other or deal with a conflict as well. So you can play with that sort of stuff. And then another way to think about it is a transactional analysis thing, which is looking at the kind of states that we're in. So that idea is around our parent state and adult state and child state, and that each of us in our own personalities have a different way of being that can fit with each of those sort of states. So you might behave in the parent state, or you might behave as an adult state, or you might behave as a child state. And then, as you were saying, you know, how does a character react with another character? Well, this character might bring out the parent state mm-hmm. in another character, but the child state in a different character, or stay in mm-hmm. adult states together with another character. So they behave really differently with each other if you start taking that sort of stuff into effect, which is mm-hmm. kind of fun.
Yeah.
And even thinking, like, if someone's, say, like you had submit, logic, anger as your three responses, and that was how you saw things going, and then someone reacts with anger to the small thing, like I would, as a person, I would react kind of badly to that, because if mm. someone was getting angry at me over what I perceived, so even there's that kind of reaction too. It's kind of like how others are reacting to this person mm. who, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, we can see that probably everyone's sick to death of hearing about the whole Will Smith Oscars thing. but you can see that kind of thing happening A, with him in the moment, you know, when the camera's on him and the joke initially hits and he's kind of laughing along with it, there's a little bit of that submitting and going with the flow thing. And then I don't know if there's a logic moment, the camera didn't stay on him long enough to see that, but then he jumps to the anger moment. And then people's reaction to that, you can kind of see some people are like, oh, no, I would never jump to anger over that. And then other people are going, actually, you know, well, I would. Mm. And so, yeah, different people's sequence have an effect on how they view other people when they behave in that way.
Mm, yeah, it's interesting. Do you know what the other thing, like, so Cheryl was talking about how it affects how people talk and how their body language, but what about things like the setting, like affecting how people act? Do you have anything, like, any opinions or any thoughts on that? Like someone being in Disneyland versus someone being in a dystopian future, and how you could use these psychological theories to kind of determine how they might act or think or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, with the fun thing about being an author, of course, is that you can create your setting and use it to create mood and emotion, or reflect the mood and emotion. So that, I guess, comes into that as well. But yes, certainly the atmosphere that someone is in is going to affect how they feel and how they behave. Mm. The last, was it the last one or the second to last one? Of the Harry Potter movies, you can see that quite clearly where they're stuck in the tent and oh my god, it's boring
and
and I'm like watching it going, oh, I'm ready to punch each other in this tent, and the characters behave like that, and of course they're also affected by the Horcrux. But yeah,
the
situation is affected. Yeah, okay, they're magically enhanced to be grumpy with each other, but you know.
Move it along. The setting, yeah, is, that's what you were thinking, right? Move it along.
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, the setting affects their moods and it affects our moods as we're watching it as well, I thought.
Yeah. So the setting is a big, the reason I asked that is I've been listening to a Maggie Stiefvater course on that, and she talks about setting quite a lot as affecting quite a large part of her books. And I'm just sort of thinking you would get a character that was already pushed to the edge, telling themselves like a narrative around I'm a bad person or whatever, and then they're put in an environment that's actually, I don't know, dangerous, or they would be pushed further towards something than someone who was, I don't know, feeling happy and lucky and joyous. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's there's that kind of thing, like how a character would react to the environment that you're putting them in, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can use that setting to either challenge how they're feeling or to enhance how they're feeling. Mm. You know, there's a reason Gotham's all dark and dreary and Batman's all broody, you know. They go together.
It depends what's going on in the character's background, doesn't it? And then you put them into a setting and then wham, you know, there no one knows what's going on. Like none of us knew Will Smith was gonna, you know.
Yeah.
Did we? Right, because he's never done something like that before that we can know of, not that I know him personally, but obviously something going on there, right? That's behind the scenes, isn't it? It's like what makes your character get to that point.
Exactly. And it ties back to what we were saying before about, you know, looking for things in the world around you that support your pre-existing beliefs and expectations of the world. And I don't want to comment on Will Smith's psychology because I don't know the guy, but you know, there could be stuff that, you know, was a real trigger for him and what happened. And Batman, you know, given his dark and dreary past, you can kind of see he seeks out the dark and dreary and in Gotham, and you know, there's a reason for that. You know, he could go. Yeah, he could move.
Yeah, I mean, come on.
He could go live in Hawaii and have a nice time. The man's rich, for goodness sake.
And of course, it opens up the world to your readers, their conjecture over why something is like it is. You know, and you know, and if you're writing a mystery, you know, down the track, you can reveal that actually it was because of this, or you know, and I think there are different ways to use it. To mix it up and to not have it so clear cut that they behave this way because of this, because there might have been other mitigating circumstances like atmosphere or, you know, setting or other people.
Yeah.
But that's the clever writer, isn't it? The one that can evoke all that emotion, you know, about a character, and we're all left wondering why they're behaving the way they are, you know. And there's all
it should make sense in the end though, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a really key thing. And one of my tutors, who was also my supervisor for a long time, said something that has always stuck with me. And she said, everybody makes sense in their own way, in their own head.
We
looking at them might think, this behavior is completely off the wall. What are you doing? But when you actually drill down into what's their experience, what's their beliefs, what's their understanding of the world, where do they come from, it makes sense in their own way, in their own head. And that's, you know, something that is helpful when we are dealing with other people in the real world, but it's also something that's really, really helpful when we're creating characters, is that we have to set up their situation and their background in such a way that whatever completely off the wall thing we have that character do in the book has to make sense
for them. That's my theory why true crime podcasts are so popular these days as a true crime listener. I think part of that is trying to understand the bit that makes sense to maybe kill somebody or to, you know, be a serial, you know, stalker or whatever. It's that I think most of us, I think there's always that fascination with, you know, how can they justify that or how can they do that? But like, I mean, it doesn't have to be on that scale. be on a character in a romance scale. Like why would they not just leave Gotham and buy a nice house on a tropical island somewhere and live in the sunshine?
Go get a condo in one of those gated communities, you know, and have all that stuff there. Yeah, you know, why not?
But this is the reason why, because we know his backstory, right?
Right.
Like we know his backstory. And of course he's never going to leave Gotham because he's got his reasoning. Parents were killed, people. His parents were killed.
And then see, being a panther, I can just write the story and then halfway through go, oh, that's why he did what he did. Whereas Darian starts and he goes, he's doing this because of this, this and this.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. How lucky is that?
And so you're working on instinct and then, at some point later you'll go, oh, look, the theory fits. How convenient.
I hope so, right?
Seems to be working for you, Wendy.
And that's really interesting because I think you said it in your book as well. A lot of authors are doing it by instinct. They have an understanding. They're observers. They're maybe watching lots of true crime podcasts or television shows or whatever, you know, like they're gathering this information instinctively and seeing it and understanding it in a certain way. Yeah.
That would be quite good.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, that's where I hope, you know, obviously if you're a planner, then it's great to do that at the start. If you're doing it by instinct, my hope is that the book is helpful for those moments when you get stuck.
I was just going to say that. It'd be perfect for when you are stuck if you are a pizza.
So can we talk about villains? So, I mean, So just expound on how you would use this for your villains. What would you do?
So I think even in some ways, even more important to do it with your villains, because yeah, you do need to find a way for what they're doing to make sense. I mean, there are some wonderful villains throughout history where they, for whatever reason, woke up in the morning and went, I'm going to be evil. And they do it with such flair that we just don't care.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But mostly I think these days that doesn't necessarily come off well, because who does that? Who wakes up and goes, I'm going to be evil? Yeah. Nobody really thinks that they're the villain, usually. They have good reasons for why they're doing what they're doing, and they can justify it to themselves.
It's everybody else that has the problem.
Well,
exactly. What's that movie when these characters going, are we the villains? We can't be the villains. Like, we're the good guys, right? And that always struck me. It was people never think they're the villains. They always think they're doing the,
Exactly. And if you do it really, really well, you know, you see some of the villains in some of the movies recently, you know, Black Panther, I think, was a really great example where, you know, Killmonger at the end of that, you're going, yeah, the man's got a point. But, you know, obviously went around it about
wrong
it completely
way.
The wrong way.
Yeah, we're not encouraging.
We don't encourage murder and whatnot. only fictional murder. Murder is fun. Yeah. Real murder, no.
No, bad.
But, you know, so, yeah, if you do this kind of stuff with your villains, it does make them more relatable. It does make them more understandable. And you know, that creates an interesting experience, I think, for the reader.
Well-rounded characters everywhere you go, right? You want them to be fully thought out.
The good, the bad, and the ugly.
The villains can't be that sort of villain, you know, like that we see, that we used to get. They've got to have a little bit
mustache
of a
mustache twirling.
You know, they've got to have a depth. You know, baddies can't be just baddies. There's got to be a reason they're baddies, you know, you know. And just, you know, I personally had, I remember someone saying that to me, you can't just have someone walking and wearing a dark coat and looking evil, you know. That's just too much of a cliche, mate. Work with what you've got with the baddies.
The whole, you know, I'm going to destroy the world, okay, well, why, where are you going to live then? Think it through.
Thanos.
Okay, that's cool. The other thing I wanted to talk about was I remember going to a workshop with a guy called Steve Kaplan, who was like a Hollywood script writer years and years ago. And one thing he always talked about was writers having characters do things for the sake of the plot instead of because of what a character would do, you know, like, and so could you talk a bit about that? Like, how do you make it so that, you talked a little bit earlier, but, you know, making the character and the plot kind of interweave, but can we sort of expound on that?
Yeah. And I think that's, it is definitely something that you have to have in mind. And sometimes it means that actions in the plot can't happen. And I guess the pantsers might recognize this. My first fantastic novel that no one will ever read, my villain at the end, she was supposed to, in the big climactic, you know, magic showdown, when she realized she'd failed, was supposed to kill herself. And I was in the process of writing that, and she picked up the knife, and the character basically looked at me and went, sod off, threw the knife at the hero and ran away. and I was like, what just happened? I don't understand this. And the final scene was her, actually. But, you know, that was because that didn't match the character. You know, why would this person do this? So, you do run into trouble when you try and force a character to to act out of character.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean that you can't set up a situation where they have to act in ways that they wouldn't normally act, because, you know, to be, there's a great saying, and I can't remember exactly how it goes, but it's kind of like, you know, an insane reaction in a sane, and in an insane situation is sane, or something mm-hmm. along those lines.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, depending on the situation that you're in and the pressures that you're under, you might act, you know, mm-hmm. oddly. But again, it comes back to that everybody has to make sense, or does make sense in their own way. Mm-hmm. They don't necessarily make sense to the other characters or the other people watching, but they yeah. make sense in their own way. Yeah. And so if you can set that up, so you need them to do whatever it is for the plot,
mm.
but it's not really in their character, you're going to have to do something to exert some pressure on that character mm. To push them to do that in a that way that is believable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You need, yeah. You need to set that up. I think, that's a problem that maybe, you know, that if you know what it's supposed to be, but the readers mm. don't, then it's still not going to make sense to the reader. You've got to set it up for them as well.
Out of character.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
So all of the stuff that you're doing, planning out prior to starting your novel, make sure that it's actually incorporated into the novel so that people know and understand what their motivations are and their character.
Yeah. Yeah. And where you might need to add some extra pressure and extra lever to get that character to do something that you need them to do. You know, if you need to kidnap some family members, then
do
it.
You've got to do it, you know, like you do, unfortunately.
I think most authors have had something back from the editor that says, why?
Why have you done
it? Why would they do that?
Because I wanted them to.
That's
the story.
You've got to be able to give them that reason, and then you've got to be able to show the reason so the readers understand it.
My edit just came back and the lady said to me, you have to stop people getting kidnapped. Seriously. You know, like, just move on from the kidnapping, or we're going to change the name of the town to Kidnapville. Okay. And I was just like, damn. Obviously, clearly, I like all my kidnapped characters to be
funny.
I'm gonna stay away from you. I'm a bit worried.
You've got to watch out for Wendy.
Come on.
But then again, you see, the kidnap, it's a trope and people love it. So I would argue if it's working.
Maybe not
even the work. No, I think other things that can happen.
I went back to her and I just said, right, I'm just going to shoot him then. And she's like, excellent. That works. I mean, only with your editor could you have a conversation
that. Yeah, I think you're being monitored by the FBI. I'm just saying.
It's so fun to have these conversations in like a cafe and you get the sideways looks. You're like, you're kidnapping, you're stabbing, you're doing what?
Maybe we should move a little bit away. So are there, like, one of my favorite tropes is the grumpy sunshine. So if you were going to take grumpy sunshine, so it's like the grumpy character with the wound and then the sunshiny sunshine character, who sometimes also has a wound for, that's why they're sunshine. Mm. And it's the different. So can you talk about that, how someone might kind of go about, I don't know, using some of these theories or therapies or whatever, I don't know, to create some of those characters in those grumpy sunshine trope?
I mean, I guess it's hard to kind of say this is how you would do it without having the wider story.
How would you do it then?
He wouldn't.
He might.
No, I'm just trying to think actually, how have I done that? And I'm, you know what, I kind of am in the process of doing it a little bit.
Yeah.
So I have a, okay, spoiler alert.
Don't listen, Darian.
So I've got a 400-year-old mage who is, I have a fantastic review that I love for book two that says, Drayson's still a dick. And and I'm like, yeah, he is. That's exactly right. He is a dick. And so he's kind of the grumpy one. And kind of irresponsible in some ways. And in the book I'm working on at the moment, he is kind of forced into adopting a girl, and she's going to be his ward, because she'd lost her parents in one of the previous books and has kind of forced herself onto him. And that's so awesome.
That's my favorite kind of fantasy trope.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, and you know, in some ways, as you say, their wound is kind of similar in that they've both lost people. And he became grumpy because of, you know, 400 years of I outlive everybody and what's the point of all of this? Why should I have relationships? And that's been explored in a couple of the books as well with him. And now she's lost people, but she wants a relationship and he's having to change his views in some way around that. So, yeah, I guess it is kind of figuring out, you know, what are those early messages, what are those early events, you know, so at some point he's got the don't be close because you'll lose people kind of messaging. And yeah, so then you have that wonderful opportunity to have them challenge each other, even though in some ways they're kind of coming from the same place, but they've reacted differently. And I think that's the part of the fun as well with human beings and these kinds of, you know, early messages and the psychology stuff is not everyone comes out the same with the same messages. You know, there's that lovely story about the two sons who had an abusive father and one ends up in prison and one ends up, you know, a successful lawyer or whatever it is. And the interviewer comes to them both and says, you know, why do you think you turned out this way? And they both say, well, with a father like that, how could I have done differently? Because that's how they behaved in reaction to that.
That's interesting.
And I'd also say it's also how people receive books too, how readers receive books. You know, you can get a book that you love, characters you love, and you'll see reviews that seem to see something different in that character that you did, kind of thing. You know, it doesn't mean that we're both right or we're both wrong. It's just how we experienced it. So if you're receiving reviews maybe that are opposites like that, that's not necessarily a bad thing, is it?
Yeah, because, you know, reading a book is not just about what the writer put in it, it's what the reader brings to it and the lens that they are viewing that story through. And so, yeah, it's collaborative, what their experience is.
Interesting, eh?
But that's important, isn't it, that we all perceive things differently? You know, like that's why we shouldn't judge. It's a little bit of a deep and meaningful there for you all.
And that's out of character for you, Wendy. I feel really uncomfortable with you giving a deep and meaningful comment.
Why are you calling me shallow, Trudels?
See, something about this situation has changed her and made her step out of character and be deep and meaningful.
Oh my goodness. Oh, I'm gonna have to let's put Wendy on the therapy couch and ask a few deep and meaningful questions.
We've got a time limit, don't we?
Not enough hours in the day for that one.
All right, well, if you're going to talk pantsers like Wendy, you already talked about how maybe if a pantser gets stuck, they could use your book or some of these concepts. Are there any other ways a pantser could use, you know, some of the psychological theories to help them write their next book?
Yeah, I mean, I think that having a basic knowledge of this stuff is really helpful even when you are pantsing, just because it's going to inform the decisions that you make along the way in the spur of the moment, you crazy thing. And also, you know, at that editing phase when you can go back and then you start to pick out, oh, these are the themes, oh, these are the beliefs or the understandings, or this is the narrative that my character is telling themselves that I didn't necessarily see as I was writing it, but now that I go back I can see it. And so then you can, in the editing phase, kind of strengthen that stuff and go, okay, if I do this a little bit more, that's going to bring that out more and make it more, you know, interesting and textured for the reader.
Okay,
that could help out with writing the blurb as well, couldn't it, and the hooks.
Yeah definitely. You know, it's, you know, the whole, hey, this is, and I'm not necessarily saying that you do it exactly like this, but you can say, you know, this character has always believed she had to be perfect in order to, you know, and couldn't be close to anybody, but she learns through this journey that, you know, she can in fact let loose. Was that Frozen? I feel like that was Frozen.
Elsa. Let it go.
Yeah, okay, now sing along.
We're not singing along.
No, we're not. Okay.
But even in Frozen, you know, this is a kid's movie, but you look at that and those messages are 100% there. Yes. Don't be close to people. Don't have emotions because you're going to hurt the people next to you. Be perfect. Be
strong.
And then her journey is recognizing that she can have emotions.
And the other one is Sunshine, right?
Mm.
Isn't she? His sister.
Yes.
Yeah. All sunshine and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And her journey is to learn that, hey, maybe you shouldn't marry the first guy that bats his eyes at you. And that
just not everything is always loved.
Sunshine.
Exactly. Wow.
Gosh, I love that movie.
I've seen it about 50 million times. Yeah. I'm a little bit over it.
You don't have any choice sometimes, do you?
No.
No.
That's why I like to use it as an example because everyone knows that movie far too well.
All
right. So are there any other theories that you think are kind of ones that we should learn about here on the show? Is there any ones that you've missed?
I think probably, you know, for anyone, and I'm aware that you guys are in the romance industry, so there's probably a few people listening on that. So, you know, looking at the psychology of relationship stuff is, I think, really useful. So things around the love languages is such a fun thing to play with in relationships. You know, that notion that we communicate our feelings or love for somebody in different ways. And some people, it's actually words. Some people, it's actions. Some people, it's gifts. Some people, it's time. And there's another one that's gone out of my head at the moment.
Baking.
Is it touch or something?
Baking.
Yes. The sort of physical side.
Yeah, not baking, in case anyone is wondering. Not baking.
Baking's acts of service. Let's go with that.
Cheryl's love language is baking.
And, you know, there's that wonderful thing that you can play with. And it's less wonderful when you're doing couples therapy, but it's nice when you can explain it to people.
Yeah.
But in a book, you know, and characters in that relationship, you know, they have this opportunity for them both to be communicating how their feelings are growing and completely miss each other or misunderstand each other in that kind of way. And I think, you know, this is, on the one hand, it's like, oh, you know, this is very formal theory stuff. But on the other hand, you know, you go back to Jane Austen and Pride and Prejudice, it's there. You know, she was observing human behavior and she saw it. And Darcy's all about acts of service and Elizabeth is great with words and Darcy's rubbish with words. You know, says to her about, you know, oh, you know, I've fallen in love with you against my better judgment and your family sucks.
Even though it's the worst idea in the world, I can't help myself.
Oh, and, you know, he's being quite real, but that's not what she wanted to hear because her language is words.
Is that what anyone wants to hear, really?
Not really. And then it's the acts of service that make her see the difference. And, you know, that's, Jane Austen was brilliant in doing that. So, yeah, it's stuff that I think we can learn from.
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's always been there. We've just applying labels and theories to it now, but it's always been there, hasn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. And the great authors have been, as I said, brilliant observers of human behavior and put it on the page. And this is just a formal kind of way to bring it to the surface of our minds and go, oh, yeah, that's a thing. I should think about that when I write.
Yeah, that's very true. I remember when James Scott Bell came to RWNZ conference and he was talking about, like, how to write books and kind of books like yours and other, you know, books that are people are using to help them write. And he said, my hope is that people just read the book and then it's in the back of their mind as they write, not that they have to, like, take notes and follow this, like, really consciously. Mm. It's just you read a book about all these, you know, the theories of psychology and then when you go to write, then it's something else that your brain is going to take into account, right? Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think I say in the introduction of the book, like, read it through, pick what makes sense to you, use what makes sense to you and works with your style. And if it's helpful to do the worksheets every time, great, knock yourself out. If it's just something that sits in the back of your mind and informs you as you do it, that's cool. You know, anything that helps is good.
That's awesome. So we're coming up to the end of the interview, but I just wanted you to see if there was anything else that you felt that you wanted to impart, any more wisdom, any more golden nuggets of genius that you wanted to our listeners to know about this kind of stuff that you're talking about?
Oh, the pressure, the genius nuggets. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, no pressure, but it better be good, right?
Gosh.
Sorry, I'm kidding.
I think, really, you know, as I said, writers are really good at this stuff. And, you know, this is just an extra little thing to help. And if it's good and it helps you, fantastic. I have found it incredibly useful, and I know lots of other writers have found it incredibly useful, which is really gratifying, because, you know, it's nice that I didn't corrupt my education for no reason.
Brilliant.
It's awesome. So you corrupted your education, the purity of it all, so that you could help other authors. I think that is, in fact,
a noble cause.
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Darian, for joining us in the spa today. It's been really, really fascinating chatting to you about all this kind of stuff. Yeah. So if someone wants to find you, where is the best place to go?
So I have a website, which is darian-smith.com, or of course Amazon, the temple of books. You can find my stuff on there.
Cool. Awesome. And where can we be found, Shah?
Well, we can be found at spargirlspodcast.com. And thank you once again to our patrons that are supporting the podcast. And if you want to check us out on Patreon, we're at patreon.com/spargirlspodcast.
Yay. Awesome. Awesome. Well, thank you all for listening to another episode of the Spa Girls podcast. We've enjoyed ourselves here today with you all, but we will be back. Time has come to an end, I should say, and we will be back next week with another episode of the Spa Girls podcast. For now, goodbye.
Well,
bye.
Well,
thanks.